Welcome once again, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel. Thanks so much for the download, 2009. I think it's our second podcast of 2009, our first professional podcast, our first pro ball podcast. I know Aaron Fitt and I will be back next on Tuesday the 20th with our top 25 college podcast, much anticipated, never duplicated. But J.J. and I are here to pick back up on the Top 10 Prospect podcast. Talking a little National League East, we'll talk National League Central and National League West in the next couple of weeks leading up to the unveiling of our top 100 prospects, which will come in mid-February. But JJ, let's talk National League East. I happen to do one of these top 10s, and I think the way we've been doing these is just to kind of jump in straight into the discussing the top 10 of that organization and talk a little bit about which one we think is the best top 10. I think you and I are kind of united on which ones we think are best in this division. Which is kind of funny, because when we did our org rankings, which will be released later this spring, but also are in our prospect handbook, I know you had one of the organizations you did ahead of the other, and that order was flipped by when Will Lingo, Jim Callis, and I banged out the org rankings, which I think is kind of funny that we didn't listen to you on that. But it's funny in a weird sort of way. I think I was with you on that.
Yeah, I think
after I realized how the rankings came out, I said, hey, wait a minute. That's not how JJ has them. But,
you know, but that's and it always, I mean, when you are ranking organizations, part of it is that there's always that balance of, okay, impact talent versus depth
right?
And likelihood, and balance, you know, close to the, how close are they to the big leagues versus, you know,
upside.
There's all those, there are a lot of, you know, factors that kind of go into it. And so, you know, a lot of times we disagree, you know.
Right.
We're never unanimous on any of these.
There's lots of room for difference of opinion on any of these kind of things. Any prospect ranking is subjective. There's no right answer, I guess, is the way that Jim likes to put this. There's no right or wrong answers. There are more defensible and less defensible answers. I think it's pretty difficult to conclude otherwise that other than the Marlins had the best farm system in the National League East. I think the Braves are nipping at their heels, and at the top, I think the Braves are very competitive with any organization with a 1-2 punch of Tommy Hansen and Jason Hayward. But boy, for me, it's pretty hard to beat the Marlins for a stable of impact bats, JJ. Right now, for my money, this is the best organization in the game for hitters. I don't think anyone else, even Texas and Oakland, actually comes close to the impact bats the Marlins have.
Well, we're looking at the Marlins. You got Cameron Maben, number one, Mike Stanton, number two, Logan Morrison, number three. You know, I was talking about hitters. Matt Dominguez, number six, Kyle Skipworth, number seven, Gabby Sanchez, number eight, Chris Coughlin, number nine. That's the thing that jumps out, and as good as 1-2-3 is there, I think we talked about this when this came out, was Kyle Skipworth, seven.
Right.
That's really where it just kind of sinks into me how impressive this list as far as bats is that, you know, first-round pick from last year who, you know, we like. I mean,
oh, yeah, no, absolutely. He didn't have a great GCL debut, but he did hit for power, which most high school hitters don't do when they first go to the Gulf Coast League, and he did hit with power there. I mean, he hit five home runs and 159 at-bats. That's not bad.
And number six is Matt Dominguez, you know, basically former first-round pick from 2007 who hit. And I know Greensboro –
sure.
You know, you look at the ball in Greensboro, and it, you know, it starts taking off to the wall. But that being said, a very good season, you know, for Dominguez in his first full pro season.
And he's a guy who, with the defense, has always been ahead of the offense for him. And that's not a knock on the offense. It's just that he's a special defender at third base. I had a couple of scouts tell me they think, you know, this is a Travis Fryman kind of player, a guy who's going to be a really good defender, and he's going to have some strikeouts, and he's going to have some inconsistency in his offensive game, some streaks, but he's going to hit for power, and he's going to be a productive offensive player. He's not going to be maybe a star, but a guy's going to be – I think he's a great future six-hole hitter, five-hole hitter in the right year, but a guy who's a potential gold glover at third base. I mean, he's a – really, the most comparable player to him is Ryan Zimmerman in the big leagues right now, you know, who's out of place being a three-hole hitter in Washington, just three-hole hitter for lack of anybody else being there.
Right.
But that's their sixth prospect. I mean, that's their fourth best hitter, like you said.
And you know, you really – the interesting thing also is that Maben, Stanton, Morrison, 1-2-3 – that's a 1-2-3 where you could make your argument if you wanted for number three being number one.
Absolutely. Yeah, Logan Morrison's going to be a top 25 guy in our top 100. I don't think there's a question about it. I'm not sure where he'll be in that top 25, but, He's in the top 25 or 30 guys in baseball, and probably in the top 15 in terms of hitters, just hitters in the minor leagues. He's every bit the prospect for me that Lars Anderson is with the Red Sox. And Lars Anderson was number one for a team that you think of as a really good farm system in Boston. And Logan Morrison's three here. And honestly, JJ, when I look at the Marlins, I think I've talked about it on the podcast, I have talked to scouts who like Mike Stanton better than Cam Maben.
Oh, yeah.
Mike Stanton, in terms of upside, Mike Stanton is as good as any hitter in the minor leagues with the exception of Matt Wieters. I just in terms of upside. I mean, this is a special bat. Special power to see athletic ability and power on display like this. A guy whose home road splits were not. I mean, Matt Dominguez was really buoyed by Greensboro. Mike Stanton was helped by it, but he was equally impressive on the road as he was at home. The only caveat with this guy, statistically speaking, is the strikeout numbers and the strikeout rate.
And the thing with that is that you do have to have some concern, but we're also talking about a guy who hit 39 homers in low A. That doesn't happen.
No, it doesn't happen.
I mean,
Ben Badler actually did a really interesting, I don't know if I'd call it a study. He started aggregating the data for a study on, okay, let's find some low A hitters who had a strikeout rate comparable to Mike Stanton. And the guys that he found who've made it are guys like Russ Branyan and some other guys who were very inconsistent big league hitters who struck out a lot, but none of those guys came close to hitting the 39 home runs that Mike Stanton did.
Russ Branyan needed 2 years to get out of low A.
Right, and also Russ Branyan is a guy who doesn't have the athletic ability to make the adjustments. The thing that makes me most encouraged about Mike Stanton is the improvement he showed first half to second half. It was about an 18 to 80 some strikeout to walk ratio in the walk to strikeout ratio in the first half, and it was about 42-67. In the second half, he really got a lot better. Certainly, he got pitched around and pitched to a lot more carefully as word got around the league. Hey, if you make a mistake around the strike zone, this guy crushes it. But he did cut down the strikeout rate.
While he got pitched around, if you aren't making that adjustment, that just means your strikeouts go up.
Correct. Or that you're less effective. You're swinging a ball. So he was I love the athleticism, and I love the adjustments that this guy made. And the Marlins are as high upside. Plus, they also have guys who've done it at the double-A level, I guess, is the other thing that makes me so encouraged about the Marlins system. Sean West did it in high A, then he went to the Fall League and performed in the Fall League. Ryan Tucker really dominated in double-A. I think he's a bullpen guy. You know, Jose Sader's another guy who's gone to double-A they got from the Cubs. Bullpen guy, but if you're going to be a bullpen guy, be a guy with a dominant arm.
If you're the Marlins fan, you've got to, you know, if you're the Marlins fan out there, yeah, you have to be happy with that trade.
I'm not sure how you say tee-hee-hee in Espanol, but that's what I'd be saying if I were a Marlin fan. And then, again, you have double-A hitters like Gabby Sanchez and Chris Coughlin, who I think are guys who are ready to help in the big leagues. I think Gabby Sanchez has a great chance to be their everyday first baseman next year, and I think he can hit. I don't think he'll hit for profile power at first base in terms of home runs, but he'll be a productive offensive player, and he'll probably be a much better defender than Mike Jacobs. And that's a net win for the Marlins there too. So to me, the Marlins are a team that's positioned to contend in 2009 and beyond. I think they'll be a much more competitive team than people think in 2009 in the National League East. They're a sleeper there, and I think they're very positioned to have another one of those seasons that they've had. I don't know if they're going to win another World Series, but this is the Marlins' history, and they're back on the upswing. Contrast that, I think, with Atlanta, which lost 90 games last year. And while there is help coming on their farm system, JJ, I guess we should really start the Atlanta discussion with they'd be one with a bullet if they hadn't made that Mark Teixeira trade, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
How crazy would that farm system be if they had not traded Elvis Andrus, Naftali Feliz? Matt Harrison probably would have been exhausted in the big leagues for them last year, too. I forgot about Saltalamacchia. Holy cow. And Bo Jones, who's not insignificant.
No, if you want to say where the Rangers went to being an elite farm system that day, it pretty much kind of turned. I mean,
that really is a Herschel Walker kind of trade.
I mean, especially when you look at it, it's like, I mean, there's no other way to put it. Atlanta misjudged the talent, the rest of the talent team. It's not like Mark Teixeira didn't do for that year roughly that he was in Atlanta what they asked him to do. And the reality is they did not get, if you look at what they got back for him a year, you know.
Yeah, Kochman and Steven Merrick.
That's
yoinks in a way.
That's not a comparable, you know.
It's not even close to comparable.
And
they threw in at least one too many pieces to Texas. At least one. So.
But now, that being said, you know, and I think there's some help, you know, as far as on the, you know, in the Braves farm system, there are some guys who are going to help, you know, this year at some point. But we were talking about this actually before we started the podcast. I do believe that the Braves will be better this year. It's not hard to be better than
72-90.
Yes, than 72-90. Doesn't mean they're going to be a contender, but they had so many bad starts last year, you know,
right.
Pitching. We looked it up, and it's
over.
It was
like 80-plus starts that were made by guys who really had no business being in the big leagues or in a big league rotation. I mean, like, I know JoJo Reyes and Charlie Morton had minor league success and were quote-unquote ready, but they were awful in the majors last year.
And if you had options, it's one of those things where you find out after three starts, okay,
right.
You know what? JoJo Reyes, we're going to send him back down.
Exactly.
He's not ready.
Or when you had injured Mike Hampton or injured Tom Glavine, who just were never right last year.
So, if you just take those half your starts that were, you know,
yeah.
Basically games where they were almost out of it before it began.
Well, there's pretty much like, well, we have no better option, so this is who we have to pitch, as opposed to who we really want to pitch.
If you can just replace that with, you know, what we're going to see with Derek Lowe and
Javier Vasquez,
and, you know, and also those are guys who can be more counted on than last year's, you know, 40-year-old plus rotation
yeah.
Glavine, we think, will make it to the end of the season.
Glavine, Smoltz, Hampton, I mean, to expect more than 45 starts out of those guys would have been way optimistic, and I think they ended up making 31 starts between the three of them. Now, of course, Atlanta's had this offseason of, you know, losing John Smoltz, the whole Rafael Furcal drama, not trading for Jake Peavy when everyone thought they would. I would rather keep my prospects and pay Derek Lowe than trade for Jake Peavy personally, and I'd rather have Derek Lowe, even at 460, than A.J. Burnett at 5-80.
Oh, yeah.
Myself.
No, the funny thing
even
is
if they did overpay Derek Lowe, which it sounds like the consensus is, yeah, they probably did.
They probably did, but you know what? This is the first time the Braves have overpaid for someone in free agency in how long?
Yeah, it's been, when's the last big Braves free agent signing? I mean, seriously. I can't think of one. I mean, since 2002, 2003, they've really been running a shoestring.
Right. So this is, you know,
you're talking about $85 million payrolls, which is not a shoestring necessarily, but when it's all being eaten up by Smoltz, Chipper Jones, Andrew Jones before that.
Mike Hampton.
And Mike Hampton, right? And this is the Marlins stop. This is the Rockies stop paying for him.
You know, but you look at now, looking at the Braves top 10, I mean, Tommy Hanson, Jason Hayward, 1-2, not really much to argue there. I mean,
did Tommy Hansen's scouting report not just blow you away?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it really – I mean, I've been a Tommy Hanson guy since he was at Riverside Community College. I love that guy. I love him as a prospect. He's always been a fastball command guy, JJ. I mean, he's right up my alley. But this guy's a fastball command guy. And then you start reading about it, and it's low to mid-90s. And then he added a hard slider, bringing about comparisons to John Smoltz. That's like, go back to our best tool survey I did in 2007. John Smoltz has won best slider like 10 to 15 times in his career. It's ridiculous.
That's basically comparing it to the best slider in baseball.
That's exactly what you're doing. And then overhand curveball is a plus pitch. That was always an average pitch in junior college that's made progress. That's plausible. This is a four-pitch guy, a four-plus pitch guy. Four average to plus pitches with durability, size, and fastball command.
And he's done it at upper levels,
right.
And he's shown results.
And the thing is, he was number two in September. And then he just had about as good as Arizona Fall League as a player can have, hitter or pitcher. In that kind of an offensive environment, for him to finish the season with showing the quality of stuff he showed, to dominate that caliber of competition and that hitting environment the way he did, I don't think we can ignore it. And he vaulted to number one.
When he was in the Arizona Fall League, you would have thought that for that one day they were actually bringing out the AZL, and it was the AZL
right.
Hitters faced him, and then they brought everyone else back out afterwards.
That's awesome. That's a great way to put it. I think the Braves system is incredibly strong. I like their top 10 quite a bit. I love Cole Rohrbaugh, one of my personal cheese balls, Western Nevada represent.
I'm a Chris Medlin fan. I know he struggled, then they had success, and they moved him to the rotation.
He's still a middle guy for me. He might be a closer. He might be the Braves' future closer.
But
he might be their closer in 2009.
That curveball is it's special.
It is a special curveball, and you know, Tom Batista actually signed both Medlin and Tommy Hanson out of California Junior Colleges, so that explains to you why Tom Batista is now a cross-checker, not an area guy. He's gotten promoted because he's done a nice job. Those are two nice finds.
Now, that being said, I mean, the Braves system, you know, there's always that kind of that reputation. The Braves always produce, you know, talent.
Yep.
They need this group to produce because, for one thing, I mean, hey, if you produce McCann recently, you can't, you know, fault them for not producing anything.
Right. And but, Kelly Johnson.
And Kelly Johnson. But
Yunel Escobar.
This is not a, you know, but this is not a farm system that has produced the has managed to keep up with the level of stars that, you know, they've lost.
I agree. And I think the main thing is that they have really fallen off in terms of developing pitching. And that's why I think Tommy Hansen, Cole Rohrbaugh, Chris Medlin, Jeff Locke, these guys are crucial to the future of the Braves. The reason the Braves had to rely so much on Hampton and Matt Smoltz and Glavine the last couple of years is they didn't have any other choice. The homegrown pitchers they had developed had stopped becoming Jason Schmidt or Kevin Millwood, or you know, they become Kyle Davies, or they become Chuck
JoJo
James
Reyes.
Or JoJo Reyes or Charlie Morton, and those guys just weren't cutting it. Matt Belisle. I mean, these are the guys in the last decade the Braves have staked a lot of money on and staked a lot of high draft picks on, and they haven't turned out. So it's probably better now their guys are lower round draft picks. But I think it is amazing that you look at their pitching in their top 10, and the only guys who aren't junior college guys, there's six of them in the top 10, Kimbrell, Medlin, Rohrbaugh, Hansen, all JUCO guys. The other two guys are Locke High School and Tehran International.
The Braves are one team that is going to be at least have to, I'm not say hurt, but have to have changed the way they do things because of the change in the draft and follow-up.
And the crazy thing, JJ, is they've tried to turn it to their advantage. They just are scouting junior colleges heavier than ever. And the way that Roy Clark explained it to me, we wrote about it in the draft, the pre-draft report cards, now that everyone is available at the junior college level, the Braves are scouting junior colleges as heavy as anything. They are the number one team in terms of scouting junior colleges, and it's so hard to sign high school players now. The Braves really would like to sign high school players, but it costs so much money to buy those guys out of college these days. The Braves would rather go to the JUCO guys. Guys are motivated to sign. Maybe they academically, college is not necessarily for them. They go to junior college because they're not necessarily to ride that bus out of high school. And they go to junior college and go, you know, I like playing baseball and not going to class that much.
If they want to pay me to do it, I wouldn't mind that either.
So I think the Braves are trying to figure things out. It's the Baseball America podcast. He's JJ. I'm John. Let's take a quick break and answer a podcast email at podcast@baseballamerica.com. We haven't been answering these as much, so we haven't been getting as many questions recently, but we are, again, going to start that up here in 2009, our New Year's resolution, as it was last year. So podcast@baseballamerica.com is the email address. Brian, our Brooklyn Sox fan and Red Sox fan, asked JJ, we mentioned Jared Saltalamacchia. What are the chances, he basically says, of Texas's demands seem high in this possible Boston-Texas catcher-for-pitcher swap, but what do you think a fair deal would be for Boston, for either a Taylor Teagarden or Jared Saltalamacchia? What do you think? What talent should go back to Texas from Boston? Should it be a Clay Buchholz or two of the three out of the Justin Masterson, Nick Hagedone, Michael Bowden trio? What are your thoughts on that, especially in light of Boston shopping at the bargain veteran bin with Brad Penny and John Smoltz? Do you think that makes it more likely that Boston will make that kind of deal?
I think it's actually – I just don't think this deal is going to happen. I think, you know, looking at it, I just think that if it was going to happen, it would probably have happened by now.
I agree.
There's no real reason. There's no impetus that's going to push either side. Like, what's going to happen for the Rangers that's going to push them to trade? You know, maybe, you know, you go to spring training and, okay, you know, I really can't even think of a scenario.
Right.
As far as the Red Sox, now, there's not a whole lot of margin of error this year because – it's not something where you can say, okay, well, we'll figure it out in June because you are in a division where there's two other teams. There's only two are going to get out of there.
Right, and they don't have a catcher right now.
Right.
I mean, they really don't have a big league catcher with Jason Veritek still unsigned.
But if you're looking at it, you know, Veritek's still out there, and we're just kind of in a situation where he doesn't really have many other options.
Yeah, he's more valuable. Clearly, he has more value to Boston than he has to any other organization. And yet, Boston does not want to pay him what he wants to get paid.
And the reality of this is that I still think that Boston probably holds more of the cards in this situation than he does because, you know, he doesn't – I don't see another – no one else is going to, especially – the Red Sox are the only team who doesn't have to give up a draft pick to sign him.
Right. That's the huge, huge factor when you're talking about
and the Red Sox are the only team that, you know, that has that connection where – your fans, you know, have that same, you know, that loyalty to, you know, Veritek also. I mean, that's
Now he's worth more in Boston, and his intangibles play up in Boston because he knows the team, he's the leader, he wears the C, he knows the pitchers. That's more. That has more value in Boston than it would if he went to a new team with different pitchers. So, but, I mean, right now Josh Bard is their big league catcher, and that's, you know, if they want, I don't think Boston wants to go into the season with Josh Bard as their catcher, but I think they're willing to do it instead of, you know, giving up, selling low on a Clay Buchholz.
And the thing about this is that you, I do think you can go into the season though with a Josh Bard, you know, especially in a lineup that's going to produce offense otherwise. I mean, finding a catcher who can catch it and throw it and bat eighth or ninth is easier than finding a guy, you know, who can bat in the middle lineup or anything like that.
Sure.
And once the season gets going, we've seen that all of a sudden catchers do become more available. I mean, like last year, the Yankees needed a catcher. And it's like, oh, you know, here's
a Hall of Famer.
Here's a Hall of Famer.
Exactly.
So I just don't see the trade happening now.
It really does also seem that Arizona is a better trade partner, in that there's obviously a high level of familiarity between Theo Epstein and Josh Burnes. Miguel Montero, he's not at the level of the Texas catchers, but he is more established as a big leaguer. You can evaluate him as a big leaguer. You have scouting reports from him catching big league pitching, handling big league pitching staffs, hitting big league pitching, as opposed to really more speculation. Yeah, Jared Saltalamacchia had a great winter ball, but Miguel Montero is produced as a major league player. It's a big difference.
And with both of the Rangers guys that we're talking about, there are questions on either side.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Taylor Teagarden's consistency offensively is...
You know, yeah, I mean, Taylor Teagarden is like, okay, that is the catch-and-throw guy, and we don't know what he's going to hit like.
Right.
And then you go...
And he's a rookie catch-and-throw guy.
Rookie catch-and-throw guy. And then you go on the other hand, you've got Saltalamacchia, and it's kind of more of the questions of, okay, well, how about this catching-and-throwing?
Yeah, exactly. Now, to me, Arizona's a better trade partner. Brian, we appreciate the email. But obviously an interesting, very interesting offseason in Boston and in Texas, where the Rangers have a lot of talent. But boy, there's some. I think that they wish they handled the Michael Young situation a little bit better. So it's the Baseball America podcast. I'm John Manuel, joined by JJ Cooper. And JJ, who's our number three organization in terms of just farms and some talent in the National League East right now after Florida, Atlanta?
Got to go with the Phillies. And
the defending World Series champion, Philadelphia Phillies.
And let me say, I do think that there's, if you're graphing this or if you're mapping this, you know, if the Marlins are at 100 and the Braves are, say, at 90, I mean, I think there's a little gap there before you get to the Phillies.
I think the Braves are right about where the gap starts for the whole industry. In my mind, the top seven organizations – are very separate from numbers 8 through 25. And then there's a chasm at the bottom too. And I don't want to give everything away, but like for me, starting around number 26.
Without giving too much away, you know, if you're an Astros fan, you probably are aware that
if you're an Astros, Padres, Tigers, or Cubs fan, I think, and we get the email from the Cubs, we know Cubs fans know their system is in dire need of talent. And that's, you know, even trading Mark DeRosa, I didn't like that trade for the Cubs, but they kind of needed some minor league pitching depth. I don't know how much Chris Archer, John Gaub, and Jeff Stevens helped them, but they kind of needed some arms just to have some arms, especially after trading Jose Seda. But we digress.
But with the Phillies, Dominic Brown, number one, who's kind of your definition of your a ways away but high upside guy.
Right.
Carlos Carrasco, too, who... You know, I know that there are some people out there going, Jesus, Carlos Carrasco, is he what now, 35?
Yeah, exactly.
It does feel like that he's been, you know, but he's actually, you know.
He'll be 22 in March.
He'll be 22 in March when, you know, basically he'll show up to spring training as a, you know, 21-year-old.
Yeah, he pitched the entire season at AA and a smattering of AAA as a 21-year-old.
You know, the thing that jumps out with them is I think that, you know, you really, you know, Lou Marson, 3, Jason Donald, 4. The thing they have is 2, 3, 4 are all guys who – you could see in Philadelphia at some point.
Absolutely. All three of those guys have had success at upper levels of the minor leagues. I mean, Jason Donald, there were Jason Donald for Delman Young rumors this offseason. I mean, that's crazy. That's crazy. The thing is, I actually think that there was truth to that rumor because it made a lot of sense.
Well, the thing for Donald is that what's difficult for the Phillies, now, early on, it makes sense for them, you know, okay, hey, Chase Utley, you know, how long is he going to be out and all that to where, okay, you know, Jason Donald may fill that hole.
Right, or Pedro Feliz also. Pedro Feliz had offseason hip surgery. He may fill that hole at third.
But what's got to be frustrating for Donald and the Phillies, you know, or an opportunity maybe in a different way, is that his biggest strengths he doesn't get to use. I mean, he's a you know, a very impressive bat, you know, solid glove middle infielder.
Right.
And you just happen to be, oh, yeah, by the way, you're coming up and you're pretty much ready in an organization that has Chase Utley and Jimmy Rollins.
Well, I think
not really vacancies there.
Yeah, I think the big key for Jason Donald is will he be able to play third base if that's where the Phillies choose to play him? I that's where he fits. I actually think he fits okay there. And I think he's going to end up having kind of a David Bell kind of career. Because the real thing, like coming into it, I think I felt like I had underrated Jason Donald in the Eastern League because I didn't put him in my top 20 when I ranked prospects there. I say it's our top 20, obviously. But the vibe I got on him there was people saw him more as a utility guy and not a shortstop. And then I thought maybe I'd underestimated him a little bit. But then talking to the Phillies people and people, again, going through my reports from the Eastern League, outside the organization, no one believes this guy's going to be a major league average shortstop defensively. In fact, most people think he's a below average shortstop, a 40 or a 45 big league shortstop. Because if you really think about it, the way one scout put it to me is there are very few average defenders at short playing short in the big leagues. There are a lot. Most guys are playing short. 55 or 60 is basically average for a big league shortstop. And there's no way he's that. So just grading him out, he's probably a 45. But that's even worse when you compare him. Like Jimmy Rollins is probably a 60 or 65 defender. Yeah, that'll be, on a side note, very interesting to see. Both Jimmy Rollins and Derek Jeter have committed to the World Baseball Classic. Will Jimmy Rollins play shortstop or will Derek Jeter? I mean, I got a feeling Derek Jeter ain't going to join that team to play DH.
Right. You know? I figure that's right. And he's not going to say, let me try some center here, you know.
And Grady Sizemore will be there. Yeah. But that's going to be interesting to watch. But I think Jason Donald is the perfect third baseman as long as they have Ryan Howard, Chase Utley, and Jimmy Rollins.
And especially
you don't
Chase
need
Utley
profile power.
Utley is providing your third base offense at second base.
You don't need profile power at third base when you have off the charts power at second base and at first base. But Kyle Drabek, Michael Taylor, Travis d'Arnaud, I guess it's actually pronounced d'Arnaud, Zach Collier, J.A. Happ, Jason Knapp, Happ and Knapp at the back of the top 10. My Dr. Seuss back of the top 10.
After you get to four, you know, there is a drop-off there from the standpoint of Drabek is impressed. You know, Drabek's...
Yeah, see, I think it's after seven, though. 5, 6, and 7. Those are interesting guys.
And I like Michael Taylor a lot. I mean, like, actually, you know, I have nothing to do with the Phillies rankings.
Right.
I love Michael Taylor.
I think I like Michael Taylor a lot. I don't think I'm down on Michael Taylor ranking him 6. I just think he's done it once.
Right. We'll see.
In 2008. The first time he's really produced offensively. He had a great stretch at the end of his college career at Stanford. I always think I'm the high guy on Michael Taylor, but, you know, to me,
where I ranked him in the Florida State League, but I think I definitely
it was high. No, absolutely. It was
high. High guy on.
And I know we ranked Michael Taylor over Dominic Brown in the South Atlantic League, for example, but I think Dominic Brown is a guy who the more scouts – you have to talk to guys outside the organization to really – get a great read on Don Brown, and B, you are projecting. There's no doubt this is a projection pick on that his power will come through.
And that's a good aside for just in general. We are going to have rankings that differ.
Right.
Like, one thing to just explain is when you're doing a league top 20, you're talking to scouts and all, but you really are kind of ranking them. You're projecting, but there's a lot of the context of the league they're in.
And your biggest sources there are the league managers. There's just no question about that. That is the number one source. And Dominic, the Saudi League, those teams hardly play each other. You're in four little pods of four, and you play the other three teams in your division over and over and over again. So it's a little bit of a different deal. To me, Dominic Brown's more athletic than Michael Taylor. Better defensively than Michael Taylor, even though Michael Taylor has a big arm. Dominic Brown's is better. Michael Taylor could play right field. Dominic Brown's a better right fielder, projected to be a better outfielder. Right fielder can play some center. And I just believe a guy who already has a knack for hitting for average, for squaring up the ball, and for controlling the strike zone with his natural athleticism and burgeoning strength, the power's going to be there. But who knows? Maybe he turns out to be a more athletic, Sean Burroughs. I could be wrong about projecting that much power on him.
Okay. I think, you know, we both agree the next team And if we're talking, you know, the Phillies are, then there's another drop, and but not a dramatic drop
right.
to the Mets.
I agree. Yeah, I like the Mets system better than I thought I would. I did their top 10, their top 30 last year. I ranked the Phillies guys this year. I'm fairly familiar with the Mets list. It was better before the trade they made with the Mariners, but I'd still make that trade in a heartbeat again to get J.J. Putz if I'm the Mets. And obviously, I guess the surprising thing to most people would be that Mike Karp was not the highest ranked guy they traded there, that it was Michael Cleto, the young right-hander with one of the better arms, really probably one of the best arms in the Mets system. But to me, the Mets have one of my new personal cheese balls in Brad Holt, the hard-throwing right-hander out of UNC Wilmington, who just dominated at Brooklyn. But to me, that's a list that really falls off after four. Jeffrey Marte, maybe we were a little conservative on Jeffrey Marte.
But there's a reason to be conservative there in that you're projecting a lot, but at the same time, he's number six.
Right.
And he's essentially had 150 at-bats in the GCL. So that's not...
Well, there's a chance he might end up being better than Wilmer Flores if Wilmer Flores has to move out of the infield.
Right.
That he might be more valuable than Wilmer Flores.
Right.
There's a chance of that. And we have Flores at two. But Flores has shown a much more... I think a bat that's ready to move on the fast track much more so than Marte's is.
But, Rhys Havens is at eight, as far as first-round picks, from this year.
Yeah, not so bad. I mean, he was picked ahead of Holt, and as was Ike Davis, who didn't make
the
top 10.
Ike did not make the top 10 and had about as bad a pro debut.
It wasn't Anthony Hewitt-like. It wasn't that bad.
But as bad as close. I was going to say, I was actually going to throw a qualifier as a pro debut as a college player, high-profile college player I could remember in a while.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. That's a fair way
and
to
Anthony,
put it.
And Anthony, by the way, we didn't mention it with the Phillies. First-round pick Anthony Hewitt did not make the top 10, and that's not because no one from this year's draft made the
and
top 10.
And two guys drafted behind him did, and Jason Knapp and
Zach
Collier.
Anthony Hewitt, now, coming out, when he was drafted, the thought was is that, hey, this is a high-upside guy who also could be a guy who never hits a
he
day
in the
He
could never get A-ball. Yeah. That's potential that he could never get A-ball. I mean – I Jim Callis and I actually had a really strong difference of opinion doing draft report cards. I love the Phillies draft. Jim's not as high on it. The Phillies did spend money. They spent more than $6 million on their draft class, and they had extra picks. I like a team that, when they have extra picks, takes chances on guys with upside. But they also got good college pitchers and a polished high school hitter in Zach Collier. And that's the thing. The Mets were one of four clubs that never went over slot in the 2008 draft. And yet – I thought in Brad Holt and Rhys Havens, they got some fines. And we'll see about Ike Davis. I'm an Ike Davis believer.
Right, I mean, let's
but
make
boy,
it clear.
That,
like
I said, brutal debut.
No
home runs.
He could show up and go, okay, I've learned some things from that.
Right.
So not time to write him off by any stretch. But, yeah, that was a
– But you also – the Mets also – you're going to look into the back of their top 10. Nick Evans, I think we think, is a platoon guy. And he could be a second division regular. But on a good team, he's a platoon guy. Eddie Kunz on a good team is probably a seventh inning guy, and maybe that might even be
not a whole lot of
scouts.
Impact on the back.
Right, Rhys Havens is probably a second baseman. Bobby Parnell is number five. He's probably a bullpen guy, but he's that high because he's a bullpen guy who's ready,
ready
in 2009. So,
and then I think we agree that if you're talking about drops, then there's another pretty significant drop. To get to the Nationals.
I think so. I think it is a pretty significant drop. And the Nationals were a team that we ran into our top 10 in terms of organizations last year. I think it was justified, although there was a lot of projection that was being done on a lot of young players. And in 2008, pretty much everyone in that system went backwards.
Jordan Zimmerman
is the exception.
But everyone else pretty much, if you were highly touted last year, you're a little less highly touted this year.
I think that's a great way to put it. Ross Detweiler is still number two, but he did not have a great year. Chris Marrero is still number three. He got hurt, and he keeps moving down the defensive position.
Ross Detweiler, for a guy who is a college guy in high A, that's not by any stretch should be over his head. 289 average against that. That's the part that just concerns me a little bit is that
he was hittable.
He was hittable.
Absolutely. Now, I've talked to at least a couple scouts who thought that his stuff came back in the fall, that he looked better in the Arizona Fall League, looked like a first-round pick. They didn't necessarily see him in the Carolina League. These are guys who just saw him in the Fall League for the first time. They both said, wow, I can see why that guy was drafted where he was drafted. But still, he had mechanical issues to iron out. If you're going to be optimistic about him, you have to hope that he ironed out those issues, and it took him a little while to build up that new muscle memory, really, to adjust to those mechanics, be able to throw strikes with his new mechanics, throw less across his body, and be able to both command stuff and have quality stuff.
And the best way for me to explain, you know, beyond that is that number 5 through 10 are all guys who none of them have played an at-bat or thrown a pitch in full season ball.
Yeah, that's damning. That's exactly why they're number 21 on our whatever. In our
Give
rankings.
It away more!
No, it's pitiful. Well, they're number 21 on our preliminary rankings. I can't believe I just gave that away. That's why they're number 5 in the National League East. That's where I really should go with that. But yeah, I will say one thing, again, if you're going to be optimistic as a Nats fan, Aaron Fitt and I went to these clinics during the ABCA convention, and Don Slott, Sluggo, was showing a bunch of video of good swings and bad swings, and like he was showing good big league swings and showing a lot of messed up amateur swings. And he said, "I don't want to just, you know, be negative about all the amateurs. So let's show you a good amateur swing." And you know whose video he used to break down? JP Ramirez, your number 9 prospect for the Nationals. Showed him at the area code games in 2007 with a swing that was balanced, that was strong, that was where he got the bat head through the zone for a long time. He didn't talk about the rest of Ramirez's tools, and that's the reason that he's number 9, and that's the reason he's a 15th round pick, even though he signed for $1 million. He might be a tweener in a lot of other ways, but he can hit, and Don Slott showed you visually why the guy could hit. It was pretty impressive to see him repeat the same swing, swing after swing after swing, even later in the weekend when he got tired. So that was that's a good encouraging sign for Nats fans. But you know, Jack McGeary being a number 5, when the guy's basically a part-time minor leaguer and he's your number 5 prospect, that's a problem. And that's Chris, the problem for the Nats.
Chris Marrero, number 3. I mean, there's – what you know, what's your opinion on Chris Marrero?
You know, I mean, he's 20 years old and hit 11 home runs in basically half a season in the Carolina League. That's hard. I like Chris Marrero personally. I think if you're going to hit, you're going to hit. And if you're playing first base, it's okay. Going to have a Paul Konerko kind of career. That's a comparable player for him, where a guy's not going to be very athletic or very good defensively, but it's okay if he hits 40 home runs a year. That's worth
it. Yeah, the bat's going to be in every single way.
All the value's on the bat, and right now the evidence is that he will hit, but he shouldn't be your number 3 prospect. It'd be great if he were number 6 through 10, somewhere in there.
I mean, I guess a good way to put it, they're different players, but when we're talking to put a bow on this,
yeah,
when we're talking about the Marlins,
absolutely,
and then you talk about, say, like Gabby Sanchez at number 8, different kind of players. Now, let me make this clear.
Different players.
But with Gabby Sanchez, he's the number 8 prospect, and really
it's a tough call.
The power's the bat. I mean, the tool's the bat in a different way. He's not as much power, but you know, a better hitter.
I would rather have Chris Marrero than Gabby Sanchez, but that's
not
a whole
lot of difference, though. And that's one's number 8, one's number 3.
Yeah, no doubt. That's a great point. That's a great way to that is a good way to put a bow on it. So we'll be back next week to talk National League Central. We could have a much longer podcast because JJ did the Reds. Nobody loves Reds prospects like JJ.
Actually, I'll give a shout out to Doug Gray of RedsMinorLeagues.com. He may actually love him more.
Okay, well, I'm not even Ben in Centerville, Ohio, who bombards the our weekly chat at ESPN, whether it's Jim or I subbed for Jim this week, but bombards that with questions. I'm telling Ben one more time, no more Danny Doran questions. It's been asked and answered, counselor. But we'll be back next week to talk NL Central prospects, and we'll be back Monday with Aaron Fitt joining me here for the weekly college podcast where we unveil our top 25 at baseballamerica.com. Until then, for JJ, I'm John. So long, everybody.